Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at catholicsingles.com.
Oh man, people love them some Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin, the beloved Jimmy Akin, that's what I want to call him because he's here with us yesterday for 2 hours and we're like $80,000 away from reaching our goal at the beginning of it. And at the end of it, done. We hit the goal. I know.
We did. We made our drive goal of $200,000 and that was super wicked awesome. That was great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to everybody who's donated. We're now fully funded for the next 3 months.
Yes. I said to John Sorensen, now you can't fire me for 3 months. And he's like, I'm pretty sure we can fire you if we want. And I felt like this job security afterwards, but whatever. That was so exciting. And grateful. I don't know there's no other word. Yeah, grateful to people for supporting us like that. And so in order to reward the entire earth for supporting us in that way, we decided to do what apparently is the world's favorite thing, weird questions with Jimmy Akin. So we're going to do a full hour of weird questions with you, Jimmy Akin.
Sweet.
Oh, and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Sorry, I had the word weird stuck in my head, but Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World dropped today, and it's a good one. It's about God and the gods.
They're all good.
Like, yeah.
I wouldn't do them if they're not good.
I don't know. Episode 43. No, I'm just kidding. I don't have them memorized. But God and the gods.
Yeah. So I talk about the concept of divinity because it's understood differently in different religions. I talk about... monotheism and polytheism and how the distinction is not as clear cut as people might always think.
Right.
I talk about how the biblical worldview handles the question and how God's court works, who the mysterious sons of God in the Old Testament are. They were the fathers of the Nephilim. I talk about all the different roles in God's heavenly court, including the prosecutor. Could it be Satan?
Oh yeah,
that's what the word Satan means in Hebrew. It means accuser. So he's like the prosecutor in God's heavenly court, and among other officials. And I talk about the angelic princes that rule over nations and all kinds of interesting things.
I can't wait. Maybe I'll listen to it in the car on the way home. Hey, assistant producer Marie has had a tough day here.
Oh no!
Yeah, she cut and pasted the weird questions into the document for me here. Are you okay?
Oh man,
that's tiring, Marie. Are you going to be okay? She's looking at me like
Control A, Control Z, Control V, 3 whole key combinations.
But it does make my life easier when she does it because now I've got the weird questions right in front of me, and I'm not going to give out the phone number. I get tempted to give out the phone number, but we're not taking phone calls because. We want the questions on weird questions. When we're doing weird questions with Jimmy Akin, we want the questions to be really weird. And not everybody has the same weirdometer, internal weirdometer. And so people will call thinking they're asking a weird question, but it's a perfectly normal question from our perspective. So in order to do that, we pre-screen the questions. So are you ready for some weirdness,
Jimmy Akin? I'm ready.
All right. Full of gratitude for all the support people have given us in recent days. Here we go with weird questions for Jimmy Akin. Ron L. asking by email, ask, is it possible that some sort of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey way that the transfiguration when Jesus met Moses and Elijah, it was the same meeting as Exodus 34 and 1 Kings 19, and since Moses looked while Elijah didn't, That was the reason Moses' face shined while Elijah's didn't. This is a weird question. It's got a little bit of time travel in it. It's got a reference to Doctor Who, and it's got the transfiguration and two instances from the Hebrew scriptures where Moses and Elijah met the Lord. What do you make of it?
So when you say, is it possible? Possible has different meanings. Is it hypothetically possible? Well, sure. God can, you know, space and time are not absolutes. And so God could cross-connect different points in space and time if he wanted. And consequently, it would be ontologically possible and physically possible for God to do this. But then there's what's possible in terms of the evidence. You know, what does the evidence suggest? Does the evidence support this? And it looks like the evidence doesn't. At least according to my reading, in the accounts of the Transfiguration, we have Jesus and Moses and Elijah all on the mountain together with the disciples there, seeing them apparently in a vision, seeing Moses and Elijah in a vision, and the three of them have a conversation. Because Moses and Elijah are talking about Jesus and what he's going to be doing. And so we see them interacting. And the strong suggestion is that the three of them are face to face. But that's not what we see in the account where Moses meets the Lord, because he, in keeping with the thought systems at the time, you know, you couldn't see God and live. And so when God has his glory pass in front of Moses, he only gets to see God from behind. And that seems different than what's happening with Moses and Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Right.
Also, when Elijah like hides his face, well, he's hiding his face. He's not having a conversation with Jesus face to face, which is what seems to be happening on the Mount of Transfiguration. So I would say, although it's possible, I don't think it's likely that that's the case. That's not what the evidence seems to suggest. But people seem to be wondering about this, because not only did I get email from Rob L. about this, but someone was asking this on Twitter today, and someone said, oh, you should ask Jimmy Akin. And I said, by coincidence, I'll be answering this on today's Weird Questions show.
Do you think part of the interest people have in it is they just want to say wibbly wobbly timey wimey because they know you're...
I'm sure that's part of it,
yeah.
At least in Rob L's case. And it is not good of you to catch that Doctor Who reference, because I showed you that episode of Doctor Who once. That was the episode Blink with the Weeping Angels.
Yes, you are the man who introduced me to Doctor Who, and I really enjoyed Doctor Who a lot.
Yeah. That's a really good episode.
Mark's next with another weird question for Jimmy Akin. What role do you think a guardian angel might play in the life of a superhero? And then he follows that with Nightcrawler is Catholic.
Yeah, and Nightcrawler is Catholic, and he's far from the only Catholic superhero. There are others, too. For example, the Huntress in Gotham City is also Catholic, as is Daredevil in New York. And so there are a bunch of Catholic superheroes. But regardless of whether they're Catholic or not, I think the guardian angels in the life of a superhero are going to be extra active, because they get in a lot more danger. They get in a lot of dicey situations where they have to evaluate, do I use violence here and how do I protect innocent lives? And so I think guardian angels in the case of superheroes are going to really need to have their A game.
I guess that's true. You know, for some reason I had the feeling Batman was Catholic, but is there some history?
Batman is ambiguous. They don't really say. He seems to either be Catholic or Episcopalian, but they haven't really settled that one.
All right. We got to take a quick break. More weirdness to come. Jimmy Akin is here. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin, which is one of our favorite ways to spend a Friday around here. So more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're glad you're with us. Stick around for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Prayer doesn't have to be anything rigid or formal. Of course, we have countless ones we can turn to when words don't come to mind. So rote prayers are fantastic, but I also like to pray by listening to praise music, reading the Psalms, and just listening to God's voice. Keep in mind that prayer is a two-way endeavor. Sometimes we think it's just us talking and God listening. If that's what your prayer life has mainly consisted of, try getting used to listening to God speak to you. You'll hear beautiful and amazing things.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's a good thing because the episode today is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and that those are no good when Jimmy Akin's not here. All right, this question is, what on earth? I'm sorry to be interrupted, but what on earth are you holding, Jimmy Akin?
I'm holding, for those who are seeing this streaming, I'm holding Amigurumi Jimmy. So this is something, since you mentioned Mysterious World, it brought this to mind. Some of the fans of Mysterious World send in fan art.
And, that's one of the best things about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I know you've got some art from some of your young listeners, and yeah, I love it when you share that.
But, and also professional artists and various people.
This is a professional.
Yeah, so one woman, her name is Heather C., decided that most of the fan art I get is, you know, drawings and stuff like that. But she said her talent is with yarn. And
it is a talent.
Amigurumi, which is a Japanese craft where you make little dolls or figurines out of yarn. And so she made an Amigurumi Jimmy as her fan art submission, and she sent it to me. So I have an Amigurumi Jimmy here. It's got me. It's got my hair. It's got my beard made out of orange yarn. It's wearing a purple shirt.
She got the wardrobe correct, too.
Which I frequently wear. I'm wearing a purple shirt now. She's got the white pants. She's got a white removable cowboy hat. And it looks absolutely awesome. And so I've put the picture on my website. I put it on Facebook if you want to see it. But I thought I would share it with you, Cy Kellett, and with our audience today. So Amigurumi Jimmy.
That is awesome. What's her name? Because
yeah.
She did a great job on that.
Heather C.
Heather, you did a great job. If we can get an Amigurumi Cy, I want to do, like, we could do a video where the two of them talk to one another and we could do the voices.
Or battle. You know,
oh, I don't want to do battle.
Well, I'm a boy. I have a Y chromosome. So I instantly think, what do you do with action figures? You have them battle.
That is really cool. If you're not watching the video now, you should take a look at the video later to see. The best thing, though, is like it's like the time Jimmy wore celery, where he just doesn't say anything. I look up and then something new is going on. There was Amigurumi Jimmy. Well, he looks good. Tiny little Jimmy. All right, I got another weird question for you, Jimmy Akin.
Okay.
It's not that weird, though, because it involves J.R.R. Tolkien, and that's not that weird. Would prayers or sacraments—oh, this is from Ron, by the way. Would prayers or sacraments be valid in a fictional language like Elvish? Now, he qualifies. Elvish is unique because, A, it's a functioning language with grammar and syntax, not merely gibberish, which I feel like might be a stab at the people who speak Klingon, but that's a functioning language too.
Klingon is a functioning language,
I just
yes.
don't want Ron getting uppity, like, oh, the Tolkien languages are better. But his B point, I'm sorry, Ron, if I read into that what I shouldn't have. If I read into that uncharitably, I apologize. His B point is J.R.R. Tolkien actually composed several Elvish prayers, such as the Our Father and the Hail Mary. Well, then he didn't compose them. He just translated them. That's not composing.
Them.
Yes.
And they've also been translated into other languages, including Klingon. So you can say the rosary in Klingon if you want. Also, there is a famous text from the Bible from Genesis. It's called the Babel text because it's the account of Babel. And it's a classic passage that when you're translating into a new language, you do the Babel text. Languages get diversified. And so linguists, for fun, translate the Babel text into different languages. But in terms of Ron's question, so first of all, we've got prayer. And prayer, you don't even have to use language for a prayer to be valid. As St. Paul mentions in Romans 8, we often don't know how we need to pray, and the Spirit helps us with inexpressible groanings. And so even if you're not sure what you're praying for, but you just have this need that you're feeling and you bring it before God, God understands that need better than you do.
So
you know, just bringing it before God, even if you can't articulate it, that's a valid prayer. And so you don't even need language. You don't need to verbalize a prayer for it to be valid. God can still respond to it. And so if you have a language, whether it's a private language that only you speak, or it's got a small community of language users, God knows what you're saying. And so, he can answer your request. The trickier question comes with the sacraments. And there can be kind of an impulse to say, ooh, maybe we need a substantial community of native speakers or something in order to do a sacrament
right. In
a language. I mean, that's something you at least want to entertain as a possibility, which is what Ron is entertaining. But how many do you need?
Well,
now, the Holy See will only approve translations into major languages. I mean, if there's a community of 100 people somewhere that speak something, they're probably not going to, take the time to translate that and approve the translation of the Mass, let's say, because those 100 people are going to speak something else, or they're an uncontacted, unevangelized people who aren't interested in the sacraments. But if the Holy See has approved a translation, that would presuppose that it is valid to have sacrament in that language. And so we can get some guidance by looking at languages that have been translated, even if and have been approved for the Mass, even if it doesn't have a large community of native speakers. And the example I would cite here is Esperanto. Esperanto is an artificial language, so it doesn't have to be a natural language. Esperanto is an artificial language. It was deliberately created to be a kind of international language and, build bridges between different cultures. It's based on a number of different European languages. And all of the popes from St. Pius X onward have supported the Esperanto movement, even though nobody speaks this as their native language. In 1977, Vatican Radio began broadcasting regularly in Esperanto, and since 1998, they've been doing it 3 times a week. In 1990, the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments approved an Esperanto translation of the Mass. So we have an Esperanto missal and lectionary for Sundays and feast days that was published in 1995. In 1994, St. John Paul II began, how he does greetings in different languages at Easter and Christmas. Well, he started doing Esperanto greetings at those times, and Pope Benedict XVI then kept up that tradition. So you've got a good bit of support from the Vatican, including, crucially, the translation of the Mass into Esperanto, which implies it's valid, even though Esperanto does not have a large community of native speakers. And so the Holy See, and they also, would check with the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith before doing that. So the Holy See's attitude is that it doesn't seem to need a large community of native speakers, just some people who speak it at least as a second language. And so if you got a community of people wanting to use different dialects of Elvish or Klingon as a way of building bridges between people of different cultures promoting peace and stuff, I'd love to see the pro-peace Klingon language movement. or the Elvish for that matter. They can be pretty aggressive in battle.
They can be a little snippy, those elves.
Yeah. They're event, if you got a community that was using these artificial languages to build bridges, they might attract the attention and approval of the Holy See the way Esperanto did.
I hope we get, just because I love to hear Carlo speak Pig Latin, I hope we get a little more use of Pig Latin. You can do Pig Latin, Jimmy, well. Carlo,
fairly well, Faye.
Carlo is hilarious doing it. And you, of course, know where that comes from. That comes from the Catholic Answers game show where...
I would have to read an answer in Pig Latin as an option of a lifeline for people.
Yeah, the best is Carlo. Because it's particularly to see a person who is competent in so many things as a musician and as a scholar and all that to be, I don't want to say this in a hurtful way, but to be incompetent at something is kind of fun. All right.
It's humanized.
Yeah, humanizing, right, for Carlo. Let's go. Here's another,
for all of us.
Here's another weird question for you. I think we've asked you this one before. Mark wants to know, where is the Ark of the Covenant? I don't know why he thinks you would know. Or maybe, Jimmy, you could do a Mysterious World episode on it. I bet you already have.
I haven't yet. I will. I haven't yet. But you can look forward to that. So clearly, the Ark of the Covenant is being studied by top men.
We've got top men on it.
Yep. Is currently housed in a warehouse. Maybe Warehouse 13. I don't know. Setting fiction aside, we don't know where the Ark of the Covenant is. It's possible it may not exist anymore. Some people have speculated that the Ark of the Covenant may have been destroyed by the Babylonians, but I don't buy that. If it had been destroyed, the authors of the Old Testament would mention it, because they do talk about what the Babylonians did when they captured Jerusalem and destroyed the temple on Tisha B'Av.
The day we just talked about.
We just talked about recently. It talks about how they took various artifacts from the temple back to Babylon with them because they were holy artifacts. I mean, they didn't disbelieve in the God of Israel. They were polytheists. They accepted all kinds of gods. And so it's like, okay, we've got this, we conquered this people. We're taking their holy stuff now and bringing it back to Babylon. And they preserved it. They didn't like melt down the candles, you know, the menorah or anything like that. So if they had taken the Ark, it would be mentioned alongside the other artifacts that the Old Testament authors mentioned the Babylonians taking. So I don't think it was destroyed. The evidence we have, therefore, suggests that it was hidden. It was before the temple was destroyed, they managed to get the Ark out and took it somewhere. Now, the question is where? In Ethiopia, there is a tradition that the Ark was taken there. And according to some versions of the story, like King Solomon gave the Ark to the Queen of Sheba when she visited and asked him weird questions for King Solomon. But I don't buy that at all. There's no way Solomon would give the Ark to a foreign queen.
No, that...
And also, we know the Ark was there after Solomon's time. So it was there until the Babylonian exile. And then it disappeared. I think what the Ethiopians have, because they have a church in Aksum that is reputed to house the Ark, and they apparently do have an artifact in there. What I think it is, and what the evidence supports it being, is a replica of the Ark that was made at a later date, and then eventually people's memories, they would venerate this replica, and then people's memories got fuzzy, and they stopped realizing, oh, it's just a replica, because they were treating it as a holy object. According to other accounts, and this one strikes me as quite plausible, the Ark was hidden in a cave. And that's a logical place. If you're trying to hide something from conquering invaders, put it in a cave. That's what the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls did in the Jewish War of the AD 60s. The Romans were coming in, they were stomping everybody, and so they took their sacred library and stuck it in a cave, where it remained until it was discovered in the 1940s. So the Ark could be in a cave somewhere. And there are accounts of that being the case from the ancient world, including a letter that is prefaced to the book of 2 Maccabees, which says that according to the traditions that the letter author is aware of, prophet Jeremiah took it and hid it in a cave. But it might not exist anymore because 2,500 years is a long time. And so it could have been, you know, broken up in the intervening time, or it could have simply decayed because it was made out of acacia wood. And wood, if you put it in a watery environment, so if it was a cave that had water in it, it might not survive 2,500 years. That's one of the reasons we find so many ancient manuscripts in Egypt, because it's dry there.
But we don't
find ancient manuscripts like that, not ones that old, in Europe, because it's wet there. And Israel has some dry areas, but it's also got some wet areas. So the question of where the Ark of the Covenant is an open question, as is the question, does it exist at this point? But it is a subject I'll be looking into in the future.
Some people say, though, that it's in heaven. You get that every now and then.
This is based on Revelation, where the book of Revelation depicts God's temple in heaven being opened and the Ark of the Covenant is seen there. That may not be the physical Ark, though, because God has a heavenly temple.
Oh.
And so it could have a heavenly Ark, just like there's an earthly Ark. Earthly temple.
Jimmy Akin's our guest. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and they get weirder from here. I'm really looking forward to the next one. We'll do that right when we come back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Does the Church have too many rules? Join me, Dr. David Anders, as we answer your questions right here on Called to Communion, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Really? This actually surprises me.
Groovy.
The actual greatest music of the 21st century, and you played it for us on a Friday. Well, that's good. That was a good choice, because we couldn't play it yesterday. because or you forgot to play it yesterday. Oh, I guess we could have played it during the fundraising, but Jimmy's here and Jimmy's usually with us when we play it, so that's kind of nice. Thanks, Nick.
Yeah.
You're all right, Nick. I'm going to take back 40% of what I said about you this week. All right, I got a question that I'm kind of actually looking forward to from Nicholas for weird questions with Jimmy Agin. And I don't know if I'm supposed to say people's last names. Do you want me to say their last names? Because I don't mind.
I would. Matt will
just
not.
Say. Yeah, we'll just say Nicholas. All right. This is what Nicholas says. How about in the future, if modern medicine could bring back people after death, what would happen to their soul when they were dead? What would happen to the soul once they were brought back to life? Now, that's a great weird questions for Jimmy Akin question.
Well, the we can bring people back from clinical death now. So beginning in the mid-20th century, it became possible to do that with, electrical cardiac stimulation. So even after people had suffered cardiac arrest, we could shock their heart back into action and save them in a bunch of cases where previously their death would have been irreversible. And when we did that, they would come back from clinical death, and they would have the same memories and the same personality, and all indication is they're the same person with the same soul. As part of these close brushes with death, people would also frequently report that they were conscious during the interval between clinical death and resuscitation, and that led to what are called now near-death experiences, or NDEs, which are quite common. They occur in a notable fraction of people who experience clinical death and then get brought back. And they report things like having a review of their life, meeting a figure of great love that may be interpreted as an angel or as Jesus or someone like that, depending on the person's religious tradition. They frequently report going through a tunnel and seeing on the other side of the tunnel a very beautiful land where they want to stay. They also report things like floating above their bodies and looking down on the doctors working on them and stuff, and even hearing conversations that they should not be able to pick up because their heart is stopped, their brain has no blood flow. And without that, there cannot be conscious thought. So it's not like they're just unconscious and overhearing a conversation.
Right.
With the cessation of brain activity, they should not be able to hear this at all. But they'll come back and report things, including even things that people in the room were thinking and did not say out loud.
Wow.
By the way, there is an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on near-death experiences, so you may want to check that out. But especially if these NDEs have any validity, and that's a debated topic, but especially if they do, there's a continuity of consciousness from before clinical death through the death experience and then after resuscitation. And that would strongly suggest we've got one mind and one soul. So the question is then, well, how long would it be before the soul actually departs in death? Well, these days, we've started to get a lot better at bringing people back. Before, you had to be brought back within just a few minutes. But now it's been discovered, and this is in a book called Erasing Death. It's now been discovered that if you cool somebody down, you can arrest the decaying process that begins with cardiac arrest, so that their body's cells don't deteriorate nearly as quickly. And it's possible to bring someone back from clinical death, if you do that, as late as 6 hours later.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. So hypothetically in the future, we could extend it even further. Well, we don't know exactly when the soul departs from the body. There are different traditions about this. In Jewish thought, there is a tradition that it might hang around for as long as 3 days. And in fact, in Jewish legend, there are even legends about the soul will kind of get confused and it'll wander back and forth because they buried him the same day. You had to, no refrigeration. So they would, the soul will wander back and forth between its home and its grave, and it's kind of confused. But then eventually, when the body starts decaying noticeably, it says, okay, it's time to move on, and maybe the angels carry it away to heaven or something. You'll note in John's Gospel in chapter 11, Jesus raises Lazarus on the fourth day. And this is considered an extraordinary miracle. And various scholars have speculated that may be because of the idea that the soul could hang around as long as 3 days before moving on. And if that's the case, then Jesus raising Lazarus on the fourth day would mean not just reuniting body and soul, but reaching into the afterlife.
Yes.
Where Lazarus' soul has already gone and yanking it back. So that's a possibility. We don't know. I would say if at some point the flames of life are so extinguished and the soul really has just moved on. And so you have a body that is not only really dead, but really most sincerely dead. And once that's the case, if you bring that body back to life, I mean, God could do something miraculous and send back the same soul, but you at that point likely would be doing a lot of reconstruction on the body because it's really broken down well and truly by that point. And if you're doing a lot of reconstruction on the body, like maybe using nanotechnology to repair all the cells and kickstart them again, there's a good argument. What you've got here is a new body. The integrity with the old body is gone, and you've now cobbled together a new body out of the remains. And if that's the case, it would presumably have a different soul, even if it had all the same memories, if you were able to rebuild those. And so, like the way modern cryogenics works, it destroys the cells in your body and your brain. And so the hope of people who are into cryogenics is that in the future they'll be able to repair all that damage. But I would say if they freeze you like Woody Allen in the movie Sleeper and wake you up hundreds of years later, they're going to have done so much reconstruction on you that it's functionally a new body. It's likely to have a new soul. It might, if they could recover your memories, it would have the same memories, but then you'd be like Swamp Thing, who's a plant that has the memories of Alec Holland and may believe he's Alec Holland, but he's really a plant with some human memories.
That is fascinating. All right. So, all right. Fair enough. So, there does seem to be a little bit like some of that cryogenic hundreds of years now in science fiction, at least some of that is the idea is, well, you want to travel from here to a star. So they just, freeze
that's
you.
That's just human hibernation, though.
Oh, so that's a different thing.
Yeah. And human hibernation is something we're working on now. I mean, we can right now put people in comas indefinitely. We can put them in a medically induced coma and they'll stay that way as long as we want them to, but they will continue to age. The idea behind like slower than light hibernation for space travel is you want to slow down their metabolism enough that they don't age, but you also don't kill them.
Got it. All right. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. We got a bunch of weird questions. We're going to take a quick break and then we will be right back. I want to remind you that right now we have a free lesson available at the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. We want you to get that free lesson. So essentially, Jimmy made a course, an entire course called Beginning Apologetics. And one of the lessons from the course with all of its video content and whatnot is available to you right now at catholic.com/free trial. We'd like you to have it in part because we want you to have it as a gift, but also so many people have really been enjoying the Beginning Apologetics course. Perhaps you'll want to take the course. And if that is the case, you can just take that class for $50 off. You get that special $50 off rate. Right now, just go over to catholic.com/free trial and register. And there you will get your free class. And if you'd like, you get $50 off the whole course.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Once you lose faith, if somebody does something to you and hurts you one time, two time, three time, four time, St. Peter thought seven was a good number. How often should I forgive my brother, Lord? Seven times? My Lord said, no. 70 times, seven times a day.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. For fun on a Friday, we get to have Jimmy with us sometimes to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin, and we're having that fun right now. Next question comes from Barry, and I never know how to pronounce this word. You could say vestigial or vestigial, and people say it two different ways. I'm going to say vestigial, but Barry wants to know, like, your appendix is a maybe not.
I was just going to say, so first we ought to mention what vestigial organs are, and they are organs in the body that are thought to be leftovers of an earlier stage of our evolutionary history. So they used to perform a function, but they don't anymore. And classically, the appendix is the one that people have cited, because people can have their, it doesn't have an obvious function, and it can be removed without seriously harming a person. Turns out, actually, the appendix does do stuff.
Yeah.
It does have some functions in the body. So it's not actually vestigial. Its function is just subtler than what was previously realized.
That's why I miss it. I miss mine.
Uh-huh. You don't have yours?
Nah, they took it when I was 12 years old. It was going to explode, so I think they did the right thing. But now I found out.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Good choice. There are, though, other things, you know, structures in the body that don't have a present function or have a very different function than what they performed in the past, like the human tailbone. Well, guess what? We don't have tails.
Most of us.
But the tailbone does help us in small ways, like with our balance, with standing and so forth. So even that has something of a continuing function. But if you go down really, really small into the cell, into the nucleus of the cell, you're going to find nucleic DNA.
Oh.
And a lot of our nucleic DNA is what historically has been considered junk DNA. That is DNA that doesn't have a present function. Now that we're learning more about DNA, you know, due to having mapped the human genome and having a better ability to sequence DNA and study it more, we're learning, okay, some of that so-called junk DNA really isn't junk. It is doing stuff that we just didn't realize. But there is stuff in there that doesn't seem to play an obvious function. Like when humans get sick with a virus, that virus sometimes gets integrated into our DNA. And so humans and all life forms today that are multicellular have ancient viruses in their DNA that are millions of years old. They have the remnants of viruses that, you know, were around millions of years ago and, I don't know, infected common ancestors we have, and they then got passed on to modern life forms. And those are vestigial, but it's on the microscopic level. So would Jesus have had vestigial parts to his body, whether it's on the microscopic level of DNA or the macroscopic level of organs or bone structures? And the answer, I think, is going to be yes, because Jesus had a complete human nature, and he was fully God and fully man. The fact he has a complete human nature would imply this, because these vestigial things are part of human nature. They're not essential to human nature, because to the extent they're vestigial, they're not performing a function, but they're nevertheless part of human nature. Mary would have had these. She had two normal parents, so she would have had junk DNA. That DNA would have been passed on to Jesus as part of his human nature. And so consequently, I would say, yes, Jesus would have the same kind of vestigial things that all other human beings have. That's just part of what he assumed when he assumed human nature.
Thanks, Barry, for that question. The next two questions involve hell and then heaven. I have to confess to you, I'm more personally interested in the second of the two. I mean, you'll see why when we get there, but I'll give you the first one. I'll give them to you in order nonetheless. Maureen wants to know, are we sure that Judas is in hell?
What do you mean, we? Because
it
depends on who you ask. Some people are very sure that Judas is in hell, for, among other reasons, because Jesus said it would have been better for him never to have been born than to betray the Son of Man, which he did. Other people, though, are not sure, and Pope Benedict XVI is one of those. He wrote about this, and he wrote about how even in the case of Judas, we can't be sure, and there are some reasons that he said that. For one thing, let's look at the statement that most people go to, which is that it would have been better for Judas not to be born. Okay, let's take that literally. What would have happened if Judas had been conceived but not born? What if he had been stillborn?
The worst that would have happened was he could have gone to limbo, I guess, if that's real.
Right, but and he might have even gone to heaven.
He very well might have, yeah.
The church hopes there's a way for unbaptized babies to be saved. And so he wouldn't have been able to betray Jesus or commit any other sins. He wouldn't have purgatory.
Right.
You know, okay, let's suppose, though, that he did get born, he did betray Jesus, but then let's suppose he repented and ended up going to heaven. Well, having betrayed the Son of God, he would have had some really serious purgatory.
Sure.
To do. Yeah. And so is it true a saved Judas would have been with really major purgatory that could have been not as great as just not being born and not having that purgatorial experience? Yeah, a lot of people would say, I'd rather not have the purgatory of the man who betrayed the Son of God. And so we don't really have just two options here, non-existence or hell. We have these other options of a Judas who repents and also and does serious purgatory, or a Judas who is stillborn. And so you can take this passage fully literally and say, yeah, it would have been better for him not to be born, either because that's better than going to hell or better than going to purgatory for a really long time. But there's another problem with saying the verse settles it definitively.
Okay.
Other than the logical problem we just mentioned. The verse is also based on the idea of non-repentance. And if you repent, that changes what happens to you. This is something that the prophet Jeremiah talked about, where he talks about it, speaking for God. He says, if at any time I declare that I'm going to prosper a nation or a city and it falls into sin, I'm going to cancel that prosperity. On the other hand, if I say I'm going to doom a nation or a city and they repent, I'm going to cancel the doom. And so Jesus here pronounces a doom of some form on Judas, but it's predicated on the idea Judas is not going to repent. If Judas did repent, then he could go to heaven like anybody else, even if he had a big purgatory to deal with. So do we have evidence that Judas repented? Yes, we do. Matthew explicitly says that Judas repented. Now, he then went on to kill himself, and suicide is objectively a grave sin. But as the Catechism says, not everybody who commits suicide is automatically lost. Even if you're in the act of committing suicide, God can, in ways known to him, provide a means of salutary repentance. Also, in Judas's day, the fact that suicide is as gravely wrong as it is was not clearly known by everybody. And so you find people, even in ancient Israel, falling on their sword to have a noble death rather than, you know, suffer some atrocity. And so just because we understand how wrong suicide is doesn't mean Judas did. He also was acting under psychological duress because he had extreme grief for having betrayed innocent blood. And I mean, that's presented as the motive of why he does this. He says, I've done wrong. I've betrayed innocent blood. He tries to give the money back when they won't take it. He throws it into the temple. And then he's so disconsolate, he goes and he kills himself. And some scholars have argued that Matthew, the evangelist, means us to see Judas as sincerely repenting. And the fact he commits suicide is a sign of how serious he is about his repentance. Now, that's not proof that Judas right. would be saved, but it does.
But it's a plausible alternate.
That we need to be careful here and not simply declare Judas to be damned, because the same evangelist that records the statement about it not being better or it being better for him not to be born also records he repented.
All right. Maureen, thank you for that question on weird questions for Jimmy Akin Hour here on this Friday afternoon. Marcello asks a question about heaven then, and I had not personally thought to ask this about heaven, but I do think this is an important question about heaven, and I'm glad we have it. Jimmy, are there pizza rolls in heaven?
The answer is there will be pizza rolls in heaven if you need them to be happy.
Why do I feel unsatisfied? Why? I feel...
You haven't had any pizza rolls.
I know. Maybe pizza rolls occupy a larger position in my imagination than they should.
I can go a little further into it.
Okay.
Jesus tells us that in the next life, we're going to be like the angels of heaven. We'll still be humans, but we'll be like the angels in some ways. And the context in which Jesus says that is one where he's applying this principle to marriage.
Yeah.
And so he indicates that we won't be married in the next life because we won't need to reproduce our kind. We're going to be immortal like the angels. Well, one other thing that angels don't need to do other than reproduce is eat.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And do we have any evidence that we won't need to eat? Well, here it's kind of mixed, because we do have, in both the Old and the New Testament, depictions of heaven as if it's a banquet, as if it's a big party that involves eating. And it may, but because we're picturing the afterlife and it has to be pictured in terms of this life, which is the only thing we understand and can imagine, those could be symbols of greater spiritual realities. So it may not be a literal banquet with literal feasting. Do we have evidence that could point that there won't be food? Well, in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul is talking about our resurrection body as compared to this body, and he quotes apparently a saying that some people had, which was the body was made for food and food for the body, so they're like fitted together. But then he says, and God will destroy them both. So that could be taken as evidence that we won't need to eat. Now, maybe it'll be a situation where we don't need to eat, but we will anyway as part of celebrating God's creation. And so you could have pizza rolls in that situation. But what we can be sure of is, just like if you need your pet in heaven, or just like if you need your dinosaur in heaven, pizza rolls will be in heaven if you need them to be happy.
All right, Marcello, thank you for asking that question. Maureen asks, how do Neanderthals fit in the creation history?
We don't know, and I'll have to be brief on this because we're running out of time, but in biology, now this is actually more nuanced than this, but in biology, two things are considered classically anyway to be the same species if they can breed and have fertile offspring. So horses and donkeys are not the same species, because even though they can breed, the result is a mule, and mules are infertile. But all different kinds of horses, they can breed and have fertile offspring, so they're the same species. Well, it turns out that recent DNA studies, because we've been sequencing our DNA and the DNA of various near humans like Neanderthals and Denisovans, we bred with them, our ancestors did. And so we carry within us today Neanderthal DNA and Denisovan DNA. And that would suggest, from at least one perspective, that they weren't really separate species. They were different races or subspecies within a broader species of man. And we don't know how the first theological humans, you know, Adam and Eve from the Bible, we don't know how they map on to paleontological history. So it could be that our first humans in the theological sense could be old enough that they include Neanderthals and Denisovans and Homo sapiens sapiens. Or it could be that the first theological humans came along later. And so the Neanderthals and Denisovans and maybe even some early Homo sapiens weren't theological humans, but were near theological humans that were very similar to us, but not identical to us.
Jimmy Akin, thanks so much. It's always so much fun to do Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, a new episode out today. It's on God and the Gods with all kinds of surprising stuff in it. I'm going to listen to it in the car on the way home. Jimmy, also, thanks for just the fact that you did about 50% of all of our shows this week. It was a good week as a result.
A little more, though. I did 6 of the 10 hours, so 60%. And me and Amigurumi Jimmy had a blast.
Bye, Amigurumi Jimmy and regular Jimmy. We'll see you next time. We'll see all of you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/Redbox Media. Experience coffee like never before.